Dream, the Basset hounds, had all been adopted. "I miss them," she said, "but they went to very good homes." "So that just leaves Lovey and Nelson." "Poor Nelson," Monica said. "Isn't anybody ever going to adopt him?"
"He's already spoken for," Nan said. "I called Donna on Tuesday and told her I wanted to keep him. He's such a sweet boy. I just couldn't give him up."
"With only 3 dogs, is Malcolm still coming to help?"
"Oh, yes," Nan replied, "every morning and evening."
"So you're adopting him, too."
"Very funny."
"Your turn," Nan said.
"Same old," Monica replied. The restaurant business was busy. Alex was still rotten. Her sous chef was acting like a prima donna, and the mothers of the bride and groom at the wedding she was to cater the following weekend couldn't agree on the salad course.
"And," Monica said wearily, "Zoe got sent home from school for wearing a T-shirt with an inappropriate slogan."
"What did it say?" I asked.
Monica closed her eyes and moved her head from side to side. "Let's not even go there. The shirt has been burned, and now, every morning, I check Zoe's backpack for contraband. But there's at least a little good news. Guess who dropped by the restaurant yesterday?" I tapped my chin with my finger, pretending to think. But Monica's smug little smile was a dead giveaway.
"Could it be Dr. Dreamboat?"
"Bingo, and he is still so dreamy." She sighed and clapped her hand to her heart. "He showed up just before closing. We shared a plate of linguine and a bottle of Chianti. He's got another late shift on Thursday and is going to drop by after to take me to a movie."
"Oh?"
Nan, who had been watching the grove of trees for sight of the returning runners, turned to look at Monica.
"Really?"
Monica tipped her head to one side.
"Yes, really. Why do you sound so surprised?"
"Oh, no reason," Nan replied.
"Nan," Monica said flatly, "you're a terrible liar. What is it?"
"It's nothing, only that I thought..." Nan looked toward the grove of trees again and the cluster of coaches who stood nearby, waiting to cheer their runners to the finish line.
"You know, Bob."
"Bob?" Monica's eyes widened. "Bob is a nice guy and everything, but he's Bob. He's good to Alex. And good to me, too, I guess. But I don't think about him like that. He's just a friend. He's Bob."
"You said that before," Nan reminded her.
"Fine. If you're happy, I'm happy. Forget I mentioned it." Nan turned her attention back to the trees. Monica looked at me and rolled her eyes, shooting me a sort of can-you-believe-her glance before changing the subject. "So, Grace, what have you been up to?"
"Besides sewing?"
I laughed. "Not much, including sleeping. But Luke..." They already knew about the amazing sewing table and the adjustments he'd helped me make to my business plan, but they didn't know about the accounting software he'd recommended to help me keep track of my expenses, or the great, inexpensive website design company he'd steered me to, or how he'd helped walk me through the process of finding and buying a domain name. Most importantly, he got me thinking about how to speed up my production. Even though I was running a factory with only one worker, I had to start thinking in terms of an assembly line. Now I spent every morning cutting, making only one size that day, small, medium, large, or extra large, and layering fabric so I could cut 2 garments at once. Also, I cut all the individual pieces at the same time, the sleeves, then the yokes, then the skirts. Working that way enabled me to have 6 garments ready for sewing by lunchtime. Sewing took longer, and by chain-stitching all 6 pieces, one after the other, I'd cut hours off my garment production time. Luke was the one who'd pointed me in the right direction, gotten me to think like a businesswoman instead of a hobbyist. Without him, I'd never have been able to do it.
"My, my," Monica said, batting her eyelids. "Isn't he helpful?
Sounds like Luke is trying to worm his way into your affections."
"Stop," I said, batting away her insinuation. "I feel about Luke the way you feel about Bob. He's a friend."
Nan looked like she wanted to say something, but a distant whoop from the cluster of coaches interrupted the thought and had us all on our feet,
eyes glued to the trees as we waited for the first of the runners to emerge. We didn't have to wait long. A boy with impossibly long legs, wearing a blue and white jersey, sprinted toward the finish line. Several moments passed before two more racers appeared, another boy in blue and the other in green, running almost neck and neck. Alex wasn't among them. Monica jumped up and stood on top of the bleachers, craning her neck and yelling, "Come on, Alex!" even though she couldn't see him. The fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh racers came into view. The boy in blue crossed the line, taking first. Still no Alex. But then, all of a sudden, there he was, dashing through the trees and pounding across the field. By this time, all the spectators, including me, were on their feet, yelling and cheering, or in Nan's case, whistling. Monica leapt off the bleachers and jogged toward the finish line, clapping her hands and screaming, "Go, Alex! Go!" as Alex, his face red and contorted, seemed to find another gear. Legs and arms pumping like pistons, he passed the seventh racer and then the sixth. The battle for fifth place was intense, and the crowd was cheering on both boys as they sprinted toward the finish. If the course had been 20 yards longer, Alex might have pulled it off. As it was, he crossed the finish line 3 paces behind his competitor.
"Woot! Way to go!"
Monica hollered and hugged me when the race announcer gave out Alex's time.
"A personal record!"
The remaining racers were crossing the line so quickly and thickly now that the announcer couldn't keep up. Monica jogged over to congratulate Alex, who was standing off to one side of the course, bent over and with his hands on his knees, shoulders heaving as he tried to catch his breath. She bent down near him.
"Did you see your time? It was amazing, Alex. Way to go!"
Beaming with pride, Monica patted Alex on the back. He didn't say anything, just lifted his right arm and stretched it out, pushing her away.
"Hey,"
she said, moving in closer. "I know you wanted to go to state, but you've improved so much this season. You'll make it next year, Alex. You'll see.
Really, honey, you should be proud."
With the last of his racers coming in, Bob was walking toward Alex, presumably to congratulate him. As he approached, Alex straightened up, glared at Monica, and said,
"Shut up."
Monica's jaw slackened a little. I could see she was surprised and hurt, but she reached out to put a hand on his shoulder anyway, saying,
"Alex, it's okay. I know you're disappointed."
"Shut up," he snapped, shaking her off. "I'm not your honey, and I don't need your advice."
"Hey,"
Monica protested.
"I was just trying to be supportive."
"When I need your support, I'll ask for it, okay? And if you're so interested in supporting me, maybe start by showing up on time." Bob arrived on the scene.
"Alex, knock it off. That's no way to talk to your mom."
Glowering and still red in the face, Alex turned on his coach.
"She's not my mom. Just because my dad was sleeping with her,"
Alex shouted, except he didn't say sleeping with, resorting instead to a more vulgar and wounding vernacular that brought tears to Monica's eyes.
"Alex," Bob boomed, "that's enough. You are way, way out of line."
I didn't really know Bob, but I'd been under the impression that he was an affable, mild-mannered sort. So when his face contorted with fury and his voice thundered, I was taken by surprise. Alex's face turned even redder. It looked like he, too, was fighting back tears.
"But, Coach!"
Bob shook his head, raised his arm, and pointed toward the field.
"Take a lap, Alex. You need to cool down."
By this time, everyone was staring, including Alex's teammates. Shame-faced, Alex swallowed hard but didn't budge. Neither did Bob. He stabbed his finger toward the field a second time.
"I'm serious, Alex. Take a lap. Now. Otherwise you're off this team, and I mean forever. It'll be the end of your running career."
Alex hesitated a moment longer, then he dipped his head low and finally jogged off toward the far edge of the field. When he was out of earshot, Bob placed his hand on Monica's shoulder, seeking out her eyes.
"You okay?"
"I'm fine. Just another day in the life of an evil stepmother," she said, pretending to laugh as she swiped at her eyes.
"You sure?"
Monica sniffled and nodded.
"Don't let this get to you, okay?
Teenagers are idiots. Big, colliding bags of hormones held together by skin and self-absorption. I had to get hazard pay for the crap I put up with from these guys.
Monica smiled a little.
Listen, he said gently. I got this. After Alex finishes his lap and takes a shower, I'll chew him out, buy him a hamburger, and drop him at the house. You go on back to work, okay?
Okay, Monica said. Thanks.
You're welcome. Bob went off to check in with the rest of his runners. Nan and I walked Monica to her car. When we got to the parking lot, Nan said,
That's a very nice friend you've got there, Monica.
He is, Monica said.
He really is.
Chapter 29. Nan. You didn't have to do this. I can still drive, I said, looking at Malcolm, who was sitting in the driver's seat of my car. I know, he said, but it's no trouble. Besides, I need to pick up kibble and some better chew toys. Stuart shredded the last two. Malcolm backed into a tight spot directly in front of Pet Parade, managing the maneuver on the first try, then hopped out of the car and jogged around the car to open my door. There were definitely some advantages to being chauffeured about. It would have taken me 3 or 4 tries to fit into that space, if I'd have attempted it at all. I hate parallel parking. And it was nice to be fussed over a little bit. Most of the time. Sometimes I felt that Malcolm went a little too far in his attempts to be helpful. Apart from the broken collarbone, I was a healthy, independent woman, and I liked doing things for myself. In just 4 more weeks, I could. As soon as the sling was off, I'd be able to cook a proper meal, bake something more complicated than oatmeal cookies, and dress in clothing with buttons and zippers instead of shapeless elastic-waisted pants and pullovers. I'd be able to fix my hair properly and prune the hedges and mulch the vegetable patch. Of course, Malcolm would have gladly handled the pruning and the mulching if I asked. He loved gardening as much as I did, and had a particular talent with hostas. Only the day before, he'd ordered some miniature varieties that he felt would do particularly well in the shady bed under the front window. I'd never had much success with that planter before, and could hardly wait for the new plants to arrive. The week before that, he'd raked out all the rotted winter leaves. I was so grateful. I wanted the garden to be in tip-top shape for the ball, and spring cleanup was always such a big chore. But not being able to do it myself was frustrating. Even so, I knew I would miss Malcolm's company once I was out of the sling. Funny how quickly I'd gotten used to having him around. What? Malcolm asked, giving me a curious look when he opened the car door. Nothing, I said, quickly shifting my gaze. I was just thinking how much I appreciate your help. You're good company, Malcolm. Well, thank you, he said with a matter-of-fact little nod. So are you. The bells on the pet shop door jingled to announce our entrance. Sylvia, who was kneeling down on the floor stocking a shelf with kitty litter, got up to greet us. Just in time, she said. I was going to call you later today. She walked behind the counter, opened the register, pulled out 2 envelopes, and handed them to me. What's this? The first one is a check for $145 made out to the rescue, proceeds from the sales of 8 dog jackets. Oh, we only sold 8? Only? Nan, this is a very small shop. That's about a 30% increase for my jacket sales in the same month last year. My customers, few though they are, love your dog jackets. You're right, Sylvia. Every little bit helps, doesn't it? But it's a good thing the dog mother's ball is coming up. I don't think we can balance Rainbow Gate's budget by selling dog jackets. The ball will be a big success, Sylvia said confidently. Good thing you brought more flyers. We went through the first batch so quick. A few of my customers said they're planning to come. That other envelope has 2 checks for tickets. One is from the Olneys, sweet old couple, but they don't have a computer, so I said I'd give you their reservation. Mine's in there, too. That's great, Sylvia. I'll add 3 more tickets to the list. Or is it 4? Oh, no, Sylvia said. Just 3. Unfortunately, I'm between boyfriends. Have been since... Let me see now. She tapped her finger against her chin. I believe it was the Reagan administration. But hey, if any nice, single, animal-loving guys of a certain age show up without a date, feel free to seat them next to me. Will do. Sylvia laughed. I'm just joking. I've been alone so long that if you actually did find me a date, I doubt I'd know what to do with him. At this point, I've decided that dogs are better company than most men. So much more obedient. I never could train my husbands to sit, let alone stay. Should have had all 3 of them fixed on day 1. She laughed again and closed the drawer on the cash register. What about you, Nan? Do you have a date to the ball? A date? Me? Oh, no. She does, Malcolm said, heaving a 25-pound bag of kibble onto the counter. She's going with me. Leaving the pet shop, we drove a good 2 miles before I worked up the nerve to say anything. Malcolm, when you told Sylvia that we were going to the ball together, I cleared my throat. What exactly did you mean by that? Malcolm glanced toward me with an amused expression, like he was someone waiting for the punchline of something he'd just figured out must be a joke. Well, he said slowly, I meant we were going to go together. You are going to the ball, and I am going to the ball, and this being the case, it only makes sense that we'd go together, doesn't it? Yes, but... I stared at him for a moment, waiting for him to state the obvious instead of forcing me to spell it out. He didn't. Malcolm, I said, you know what I mean. There's together, as in 2 people being at the same location at the same time, and then there's, you know, together. Ah. He looked over his shoulder before moving into the left turn lane. I see. Well, I was thinking we could go together, he said, mimicking my emphasis and intensity. If I wasn't so flustered, I might have thought it was funny. Oh, I see. Frowning, Malcolm glanced at me again before making the turn. Is that a problem? I've really enjoyed your company and getting to know you better over these last few weeks. I assumed you felt the same. But if I misread the situation... No, no. But, well, it's like Sylvia said. I haven't been involved with a man since the Reagan administration. In a romantic sense, I mean. I assume that's what we're talking about? It is, Malcolm confirmed. I felt my heart flutter, more from anxiety than ardor. Right. I see. You said that already. Sorry, it's just that I don't quite know how to respond. I've been alone a long time, and I... Well, I'm 62 years old. I'm 63. Why should that make a difference? I was quiet for a moment. Maybe it shouldn't, but this is a lot to wrap my head around, Malcolm. It's been so long since I even considered the possibility of a... romance. He said, supplying the word. Go ahead. You can say it. Even with Malcolm's urging, it took a moment for me to summon the word, as if the syllables were somehow too sticky to utter. Romance, I said finally. I thought that ship had sailed. Think again, he said, because it hasn't. Malcolm's tone was practical, just as even and matter-of-fact as it had been when we'd been discussing which hostas might do well in that shady spot in my yard. I found that reassuring. Fine. Let's say it's true. Let's say that After 2 decades alone, I'll be able to adjust to the idea and practice of a romantic relationship. I hesitated briefly at the end of the sentence, but the R word came more easily this time. Let's assume that, all right? Just for argument's sake. Good. Let's, Malcolm said, nodding deeply to indicate that he was with me. You were married for over 30 years. Your divorce was only finalized a few weeks ago. On top of that, you've been forced into retirement sooner than you'd planned. Your whole life has been turned upside down this last year. You're trying to sort out what your new life is going to be like, looking to fill in the holes left in the wake of all of this, which is understandable, admirable even. It's great the way you're handling everything, staying positive and trying to move forward and all that. But I'm not sure how I feel about being, well, cement. Cement? Malcolm smiled as he pulled the car into my driveway. Cement, caulking, grout, whatever it is you use to fill holes in with. I flapped my hand impatiently. It's a masonry analogy. Oh, right, he said slowly, then set the parking brake. Sure, masonry. Okay, fine, now you're making fun of me. But this is serious, I said, even as a smile tugged at the corners of my mouth. I don't want to have my life upended and my heart broken just because you're... on the rebound. Malcolm turned off the car. Nan, helping out during your recovery has been a good distraction while I'm adjusting to all the changes in my life. But I'm not an aimless man, or an indecisive one. With or without you, I'd have figured out a new direction and purpose in life. And much as I find you lovely and fascinating and great fun to be with, I can assure you that I am not about to make you or anyone my reason for getting up in the morning. I'm a man of many interests and inclinations. I've never been bored a day in my life. From what I've seen, you're the same. That's part of the attraction. Seems to me we might be able to find lots of wonderful ways to share our lives, but still be able to maintain the independence that each of us values. And along the way, we might each of us learn a few things from the other. I found myself nodding as he spoke, especially when it came to the part about being able to share life even while maintaining our identities. That was what had been so wonderful and so very special about my marriage to Jim. We could not have been closer, and yet we were able to give each other space to operate as individuals. As far as me being on the rebound, Malcolm shook his head. I'm not. Yes, my divorce came through just recently, but the marriage was over a long, long time ago. Marriage wasn't a commitment I made lightly. I tried everything I could to salvage my relationship with Barbara. If I ever marry again, I'll be just as committed. But you can't be in a marriage by yourself, and Barbara made it clear that... Malcolm stopped in mid-sentence at about the same time I realized I had stopped breathing. Uh-oh, I'm scaring the hell out of you, aren't I? Sorry. An unfortunate byproduct of a scientific mind. I tend to mentally walk through all the potential outcomes before choosing a path. You're right. One step at a time. Malcolm unbuckled his safety belt and twisted toward me, pulling one leg up onto the seat so he was looking right at me. As he reached out, placed his hand on my shoulder and leaned in, I felt my face get hot. What are you doing? Well, before we get too far into this, I thought I'd kiss you. His words were as straightforward as ever, but his voice had dropped to almost a whisper, and his Scottish burr became simultaneously thicker and softer, a voice that sounded like velvet feels, soft as a sable brush caressing my cheek. That is, assuming you have no objection. And then, if you like it, you can decide if we should go to the ball together. What do you think? Does that seem like a good first step? My stomach flipped in that same way it had when he turned around at the gate and looked at me. Oh, if you put it that... I mean, yes. Yes, that makes sense. Good, Malcolm said, because it's something I've wanted to do for a long time. Like so many things that would happen that day, his admission came as a surprise, but it was a good one. That said as much as anything about my feelings toward Malcolm. I've never liked surprises, but this was different. So was Malcolm. It was a long kiss. I suppose you could have described it as lingering, and based on the cloudy comparisons I was able to summon from the recesses of my oh-so-distant memories, it was a very, very good one. During the first moment or two, I actually tried to assess it, contrasting Malcolm's kiss to those of my Jim so many years before. But I gave up pretty quickly. Jim was the best of men, an ideal partner. Malcolm was like him, but not. Yet he, too, was the best of men. An ideal partner? It was too soon to tell. But I kept thinking about what Monica said when she told us that Bob was just a friend. If the crowd hadn't started to cheer on the first racer at precisely that moment, I would have told her the same thing I told Luke, that falling in love with your best friend is one of the best things that can happen to a person. I knew from experience. Jim Wilger wasn't just my husband. He was my best friend. Had fate not deemed otherwise, he would have remained so for life. Now there was Malcolm. Certainly he was my friend. Could he be my best friend? Could I love him? With Malcolm's lips on mine, sweet and soft and searching, and his arms pulling me into an embrace that made me melt, I understood that there was more than one kind of kiss, just as there was more than one kind of man, and that each could be the best, and oh, so lovely. Finally, at the end of that long kiss, which was still far too short, Malcolm loosened his grip and looked into my eyes. Well, he asked, what did you think? It was the voice of a man who was bracing himself for the best or the worst, the kind of anxious but stalwart tone people use to question a physician about the outcome of a potentially life-altering lab result. Hearing it, I couldn't help but smile. I think we should definitely go to the ball together. Definitely. And I think you should kiss me again. He didn't wait to be asked twice. The second kiss was just as good as the first, even better, in fact, because this time I kissed him back. I slid my fingers slowly along his shoulder and the length of his neck up into his hair. I admit to feeling tentative at first, hesitant, like a musician who is trying to remember the exact position and placement of her fingers on the keyboard after a years-long lapse at the piano. Even so, it was an elating sensation, the thrill that comes from breathing an old ember into new flame. When we finally broke apart, I was smiling. Like riding a bicycle, I laughed. All comes back to you, doesn't it? Just imagine if the emergency brake wasn't standing between us, Malcolm said, glancing down at the console with a grin. We might spontaneously combust. But maybe we'd better keep the brakes on for a bit. I'm no prude, Malcolm, but I... You don't need to say more, Nan. I understand. And I agree, one step at a time. The Scottish Book of Common Prayer says that marriage is to be entered into reverently, discreetly, advisedly, soberly, and in the fear of God. That was my mindset when I married the first time, though I know we are miles away from taking any steps in that direction. If I were ever to marry again, I'd be just as committed and would enter into that union just as soberly, just as reverently. Oh, Malcolm, I laughed. He shrugged. I know, hopelessly old-fashioned. Well, if that's true, then we both are. But we can still kiss, can't we? Aye, that we can, lass, he said, purposely thickening his brogue and making me laugh again. He reached for me again, and I leaned toward him eagerly, my hands arching over his shoulders. And then, just as our lips were about to touch, someone rapped sharply on the back window of the car. Startled by the sound, I quickly pulled away. Malcolm jumped too, swiveling his neck in the direction of the noise. A moment later, a face with sallow skin, sunken eyes, and dirty blonde hair appeared in the frame of the passenger side window. Sorry, she said. I didn't mean to scare you. My breath caught in my throat, and my hand flew to my heart. I reached for the door handle, but Malcolm grabbed my wrist to stop me. Wait, who is that? Do you know her? It's my daughter, I said. He looked at me blankly, and I pulled from his grasp. It's Danny. Chapter 30. Nan. Malcolm and I had fallen into the habit of sharing a pot of tea after he finished the evening round of dog walking. When he heard my footsteps on the back stairs after I finished checking on Danny, he called out, "Chamomile or Earl Grey?" "Chamomile. Not that I'll be able to get a wink of sleep tonight, but..." Malcolm scooped tea into a strainer and placed it in the pot to steep. I took a floured plate out of the cupboard and filled it with a half-dozen oatmeal cookies. By this time, Malcolm knew my kitchen so well that we were able to complete the preparations in silence. Though this wasn't the normal procedure, I was glad he left me to my own thoughts. I had so much on my mind. When everything was ready, Malcolm carried the tea tray into the dining room. Blixen, Nelson, and Lovey padded along behind him, then curled up in a pile in the corner. "Is she asleep?" Malcolm asked after pouring the tea. "Out like a light. She didn't even bother drying her hair after her shower. The pillow was soaked, so I slipped another one under her head. She didn't even stir. But she'll feel better in the morning after a good sleep and a good breakfast. We need to get some weight back on her," I said, more to myself than Malcolm. I sipped my tea. Malcolm reached for a cookie, chewing in silence for a time. "But you know it's going to take more than that, right?"
"Sorry?"
I looked up. For a moment, I'd forgotten he was sitting there. "You know it's going to take more than a shower, a good night's sleep, and a bit of weight gain to put her back to rights, don't you?"
"I know,"
I said, trying to keep the tension from my voice. Malcolm was just trying to watch out for me, keep me from getting hurt. I appreciated that, but I'd been handling this situation on my own for a long time. If Malcolm hadn't happened to be in the car at just that moment, he would never have known about Danny's addiction, and I'd still have been handling it by myself. "I called some of the rehabs I'd been in contact with before. There's a bed available in Newburgh starting tomorrow. I'll drive Danny out first thing in the morning." I closed my eyes, took in a deep breath, then exhaled in a long, slow whoosh, feeling the tension drain from my body. "This is an answer to prayer, Malcolm. An answer to prayer. All those nights I've lain awake, wondering where she was, worrying that she was freezing or starving or had overdosed. You have no idea." A tear of relief rolled down my face. I pressed my hand to my cheek and wiped it away, then opened my eyes. Malcolm was watching me. "I'm sorry I never told you, Malcolm. You were always so good to Danny. Every time you asked about her, I wanted to tell you." He shook his head and lifted his hand, stopping my explanation. "It's all right, Nan. I understand. It was a private matter. You and I haven't known each other very well for very long.
It's not just you. I haven't told anyone outside of the family.
Not even Grace and Monica? I shook my head.
I think about Danny all the time, day and night, but talking about it is just too painful. That's why, until I met Monica and Grace that night in the parking lot and asked them home for tea and turnovers, I had no real friends. I cut off contact with almost everyone who knew Danny before. I felt like if they knew what had happened to her, they'd think it was my fault.
Nan, Malcolm said, his voice chiding. You were a wonderful mother, and Danny is a wonderful girl. If she made a mistake, a bad choice along the way... Malcolm reached across the table and took my hand. Don't cry. Don't. The drugs that are out there today are so powerful, he said. No matter how much you try to warn them, kids do all kinds of foolish things. It doesn't take long to go from experimentation to full-blown addiction.
It wasn't just that, I said, my voice catching as I tried to stem the tears. Danny was only 5 when Jim died. It was terrible for all the kids, but Danny took it harder than the others. She was the baby, and I'd had 2 miscarriages before she was born. At that point, we realized we probably wouldn't have more children. I babied her. We all did. But she and Jim were so, so close. Everybody kept saying, oh, kids that age are so resilient, she'll get over it. But she didn't. Not ever. She'd always been such a sweet little girl, so sunny and eager to please. But after Jim died, she changed. Looking back, I really think she was depressed. You don't think of a child that age suffering from depression, but... I placed my hand over my mouth and looked away, collected myself so I could continue with the story. And the thing is, sometimes there were glimpses of the old Danny, especially when she was interacting with people outside the family. Sometimes I felt like there were 2 different Dannys, the person she was and the person she wanted people to think she was. That's the side you saw. Malcolm nodded. She was always capable and responsible around me. Upbeat. And so good with the animals. That part was real, I said. Danny adored animals, related to them better than she did people, I think. That was the reason I started keeping chickens and then got the goats. Taking care of them seemed to calm her. But the part you didn't see was the moody, manipulative Danny. She used to lie about... I shrugged. Well, everything. When she was 12, I noticed that the door of the liquor cabinet was open. When I checked, the key was hidden in my great-grandmother's copper kettle, where I always kept it. The bottles were at the same level they had been when I put them away after the holidays, once I'd finished baking fruit cake and had the neighbors over for New Year's Eve. But when I opened the brandy bottle, I realized that somebody had watered it down and added food coloring so I wouldn't suspect anything. I blamed the boys. They swore up and down that it wasn't them, but I grounded them for 2 weeks. Back then, I just couldn't make myself believe that a 12-year-old girl would be sneaking liquor. Self-medicating, Malcolm said, nodding. That was the beginning. When Danny was 16, Kyle got injured playing soccer, damaged the knee ligaments. The doctor prescribed Percocet. Kyle didn't like the way it made him feel, so he didn't finish the prescription. Danny took the bottle from the medicine cabinet and... Nelson and Lovey were asleep, but Blixen, who had been watching us the whole time, got up from the floor and passed across the room to rest her muzzle on my lap. I stroked her head, took in big, slow breaths. Malcolm picked up the teapot and added more tea to my cup. My mother always said a cup of tea makes everything better. Wouldn't it be great if that were true? I tried to smile. Anyway, things went downhill pretty quickly after that. She held it together at school, but home was a different story. We had terrible fights. She stole money from me. I caught her red-handed so she couldn't lie about taking it, but she told me she'd spent it on her friends, treating everybody to dinner. I punished her, but I believed the story. Maybe I wanted to. Of course, the truth was she used the money to buy illegal prescription drugs. I sighed, drank some tea. It was getting cold. Chrissy was the one who finally figured it out. One day, Danny and I had a huge fight. She packed up her bags and said she was going to live with her sister. Honestly, it was a relief to see her go. I was just worn out with her. And I really thought that spending some time with her sister might be good for Danny. They were very close when Danny was little. For a few days, it seemed like it was going to work out. But then Chrissy caught Danny raiding the medicine cabinet and, well, I let the rest of the story lie. There was no need to say more, at least not right then. It wasn't like the story of Danny's spiral into addiction and homelessness was all that singular. Thousands of parents across the country could have told a similar tale. Malcolm squeezed my hand. This wasn't your fault. You know that, don't you? I bobbed my head obediently. So Chrissy keeps telling me, and I've said it to myself a million times or more. I pressed my lips together. Saying it is one thing, believing it is something else entirely. It's hard, Malcolm. Every single day. About a year after Danny disappeared, I went to the liquor cabinet and realized that the vodka bottle was nearly empty and that I was the one who had emptied it. After that, I started stepping up my volunteer work, spent more time gardening and helping out at Rainbow Gate. In theory, I was supposed to be rescuing the dogs, but I think it was the other way around. I lowered my head, gazed into Blixen's beautiful brown eyes. Whoever said that diamonds are a girl's best friend never had a dog. Malcolm nodded. Sometimes I think they're the only truly selfless creatures on God's earth. Well, some of them, he said, reaching out to scratch Blixen's head. Blix closed her eyes, sighed her contentment, then tipped her head to one side, making it clear that her ears needed attention as well. Malcolm obliged. We sat there for a few minutes, sipping tea in silence. When, at last, all of Blixen's itches had been thoroughly scratched and she went back to the corner, Malcolm took a final sip of tea. Would you like me to drive you to Newburgh in the morning? It's a bit of a trek. Thank you, but no. I think Danny would feel more comfortable if it was just the two of us. All right. But if you change your mind, all you need to do is call. He got to his feet. I suppose I should be going. I walked him to the door. After kissing me goodnight, chastely this time on the cheek, he dropped into his thickest Scottish brogue and said, "It's a lang road that's no good a-turnin'." I smiled.
What?
Something my mother used to say. It's a long road that's got no turning, he said. You've walked this road a long time, Nan. I imagine you'll be walking it a long time yet. Come tomorrow, God willing, you and Danny will be walking in the same direction, the right direction.
I hope so.
So do I. He placed one hand on each side of my face and kissed me once again. Sleep well. I didn't sleep well. I lay awake wondering how long Danny would need to be in rehab and how I would pay for it. It wasn't cheap, and Danny didn't have insurance. It could add up to thousands. But if that's what it took to save her, then I'd find a way. Somehow, I'd sell the house if I had to. I worried, too, about the detox phase of treatment. It was bound to be rough, and Danny seemed so frail. I worried about whether or not to tell the other kids, but decided against it, at least for the time being. I worried about what would happen once Danny completed the program. Would she move into a place of her own? Into a halfway house of some kind? Would she be better off coming home for a few months? Or should she get as far away from Portland as possible? Finally, sometime after 2, I fell asleep and woke up again around 6:30 when Nelson started scratching at the bedroom door, demanding to be taken out for his morning wee. Nelson didn't have the most reliable of bladders, so I put on my bathrobe and crept down the hall. On the way, I poked my head into Danny's room, relieved to see her tangled blonde hair on the pillow. I tiptoed downstairs, let the dogs out, then started brewing coffee and making toast. Later, I'd make some eggs. In the meantime, a good strong cup of coffee and a piece of raisin toast should help ease Danny into the new day. She'd never been a morning person. Once the toast was buttered and the coffee poured, I let in the dogs. They bounded into the house and up the stairs. I followed, carrying the tray. It wasn't easy with only one arm, but I managed. I could hear the shower running in the guest bathroom and saw the light shining out underneath the door. I carried the tray into Danny's room and set it down on the dresser. "Think they'll be able to teach you to make your bed when you're in rehab?" I muttered, seeing the rumpled sheets and the quilt lying on the floor. God knows I never managed it. I went back into the hallway and stood next to the bathroom door. "Danny, I made raisin toast and coffee to get you started, but how do you want your eggs, omelet or scrambled? Danny? Honey?" Hearing nothing aside from the hiss of the shower, I pressed my ear to the door and called her once again, louder this time. Nothing. I knocked as hard as I could, waited a moment, then opened the door and pushed aside the shower curtain. Steam billowed out, but the shower was empty. I walked quickly down the hallway, opening each door, checking each room, with Blixen and Nelson close on my heels, calling Danny's name. Blixen let out a series of barks, as if she, too, were calling for Danny. Heart pounding, I raced down the stairs. The front door was open. Danny was gone. So was my purse and all the money inside.
Chapter 31. Grace. Though I had hoped to have 35 dresses in stock for my opening day at the Saturday market, when I finished the 34th, around 3 o'clock on the afternoon before, I shut down my sewing machine. Saturday was going to be a long day, and I needed a break. I slipped on my tennis shoes and took Maisie for a walk around the neighborhood, concerned when we passed the concrete planters and saw no sign of Sunny. She did that sometimes, disappeared for a day or two, or even as long as a week, and always turned up. What if, one day, she didn't turn up? Who would I call? Who would even care? She was an adult, of course, free to come and go as she willed, and there was nothing I could do to keep her from it. But I couldn't keep from worrying about her. I was worrying about a lot of things that day. In particular, I was worried about what Saturday would bring. I'd spent the last 3 weeks sewing dresses, beautiful dresses, any one of which I would have loved to wear. But just because I loved them didn't mean other people would love them or buy them. What if I'd put in all this effort, put my search for a real job on hold, and nobody bought anything? What if I failed? Back at home, I ate half a turkey sandwich, left over from my lunch the day before, then sat down on the sofa and turned on the television, surfing channels and trying, unsuccessfully, to find something to watch that would hold my attention and silence the questions and doubts that kept circling my brain. Finally, I shut it off and got out my sewing basket. I'd been sewing nonstop for weeks, but I hadn't touched my quilt blocks at all. Hand sewing always calmed me, quilting especially. Sewing the seams, stitch by stitch, I would quickly fall into the rhythm that allowed me to focus on the task at hand and clear my head of worry. And it was such a pleasure, after putting in the last stitch, to unfold the patches like the pages of a book and reveal the pattern, see the colors and contrast between the patches and how pretty they looked together. It was a small sort of accomplishment, I realized that, but satisfying nonetheless. I took out a bag with triangles for a star block I'd cut out just before immersing myself in dressmaking. The patches were blue and red plaid, cut from a shirt I'd always thought brought out the blue of Jamie's eyes. I threaded my needle and started stitching, but halfway through the first seam, for the first time in many days, I dissolved into tears. What if I failed? What if? Tears gave way to sobs. Hearing them, Maisie ran to the sofa, yipped and fussed, then jumped onto the sofa and started licking my face. Another day it would have helped, maybe even made me laugh through my tears. Not then. I felt afraid and lonely. And homesick. More homesick than I'd ever felt in my life. Which was pretty ridiculous considering I was home. What was I doing here? What if I never felt at home anywhere ever again? What if I failed? Eventually, I'm not sure when, I fell asleep on the couch. I dreamed I was walking in downtown Portland, in the park blocks, and Jamie was walking with me. We were holding hands, and I was wearing one of my twirly skirts, the one with the flamingos, and I felt so happy. It was Farmer's Market Day, and there were people everywhere, walking across the bright green grass, wandering among booths, sampling cheeses and fresh-baked bread, picking through produce to find the sweetest strawberries, the freshest lettuce, buying pizza and tamales and bowls of noodles, finding a bench and picnicking under the high green canopy of sheltering trees. We strolled past the college library into the cool shadow of the giant copper beech tree and were suddenly surrounded by people, by women. They were all wearing bright cotton dresses and skirts, patterned with fruit and flowers and birds, with polka dots and paisley and bright, cheerful plaid, dresses I had made. And they were old and young and fat and thin and beautiful and smiling. Jamie was smiling, too. He squeezed my hand. Look what you did, babe. Look what you started. I'd planned to get up at 5 and arrive at the market well before 7, but I fell asleep on the couch before setting my alarm. Fortunately, the weather was fine on Saturday. The sun beamed bright rays through the pane of my bow window and shone on my face, waking me a little before 6. 15 minutes later, I was slipping my feet into a pair of red pumps that perfectly matched the clusters of cherries on my new dress. I spun around in a circle to test the twirl and looked down at Maisie. Well, what do you think? Cute, right?
Maisie, whose dog jacket was made from the same cherry print and mint green polka dot fabric as my dress, sneezed and let her tongue loll out of her mouth.
Absolutely. If there was such a thing as a cuteness meter, we'd be breaking it right now. I put on some red lipstick, looked myself over in the mirror one last time, and took a deep breath. Maisie stood up on her back legs and pawed at my calf. You're right. No need to be nervous. If we're not ready now, we never will be. Let's go. The Portland Saturday Market was founded in 1974 by two women, artists who envisioned a non-profit, open-air venue where artisans could sell handmade crafts and food items. In the early years, the market was smaller and more freeform in terms of setup. Now, it's a well-oiled machine. Every Saturday from March through Christmas, vendors line up early, awaiting the 7 o'clock allocation of over 250 8-foot by 8-foot booth spaces before setting up their booths and organizing their displays in time for the 10 o'clock opening. Maisie and I arrived at Waterfront Park just before 7, got our booth allocation, and were back at the car by 7:30. The flatbed dolly that Luke had loaned me made hauling everything a lot easier. Between display tables, a chair, a tent, my sign, a cash box, Maisie's dog bed, and all my products, there was a lot to carry. Besides the dresses and skirts, my booth would also carry dog jackets. That, too, was Luke's suggestion. When I called Nan and offered to sell the jackets for Rainbow Gate if she'd split the cost of the booth, she was thrilled. Thinking it would be good marketing, I quickly stitched up a new dress for myself and matching jacket for Maisie. Pairing my dress with the red pumps was probably not the most practical choice. By the end of the day, my feet were killing me. But I felt pretty and fresh and happy in my new dress. Judging from the way Maisie pranced around in her little jacket, I think she felt the same. The pop-up shade tent I'd found used on Craigslist turned out to be trickier to set up than I'd anticipated. Lucky for me, Diane, one of the other vendors who'd been selling her ceramics at the market for nearly 10 years, stopped and gave me a hand. I was ready by 9:15, but when I looked around at my neighbors' booths, my heart sank. Compared to the other vendors, my display, a wheeled clothing rack and table where I'd laid out the dog jackets, was kind of primitive and not very conducive to encouraging sales. As I was rearranging everything for the fourth time, Luke arrived, carrying a white paper bag and a cardboard coffee tray with two cups. "Well, hi," I said, smiling as he approached. "I wasn't expecting you."
"I couldn't miss your debut, could I?"
"Thought you might need a little sustenance," he said, reaching into the bag and pulling out two fresh, flaky chocolate croissants, then handing one to me.
"I brought lattes, too, just plain. I wasn't sure what flavor you liked."
I bit into a croissant and groaned with pleasure. "Oh, so good," I said, taking a grateful slurp of my latte. "I woke up late and didn't have time for breakfast. Once again, Luke Pascal saves the day. Thank you."
Maisie yipped and pawed at Luke's pant leg.
"Maisie," I scolded, "stop that. Have some manners."
"It's okay," Luke said, reaching into the pocket of his jeans and pulling out a little plastic bag. "She just smells the leftover chicken. I thought Maisie might need some breakfast, too."
He fed Maisie a tiny piece of chicken, and I shook my head. "Luke, you think of everything."
"I try."
While Maisie scarfed down the rest of the chicken, I showed Luke around the booth, sharing my concerns about displaying my merchandise. "You can't really see anything unless you actually come into the booth," I said.
"I was thinking about that a couple of nights ago," Luke replied. "Can I borrow the dolly?"
"Sure. It's yours anyway. But why do you need it?"
"You'll see. Be back in a flash."
A flash turned out to be 20 minutes. The closer it got to 10, the more anxious I felt, so nervous and preoccupied that I kept looking at my wristwatch, forgetting about the frozen hands. Even so, as the minutes I couldn't track ticked by, the doubts returned. What if no one bought anything? What if, at the end of the day, I had to take home every one of these dresses and skirts? Okay, sure, I could give them away. But then what? When I woke up this morning and remembered the dream, I'd felt so certain that everything would be fine, that Jamie had returned to give me his blessing. But that could have been wishful thinking, couldn't it? After all, it was only a dream. If Jamie had been there, what would he really have thought about all this? I stopped fussing with the hangers and closed my eyes. Always in the past, it had been easy to imagine Jamie's response to any number of questions or observations. But today, he was silent. His expression was blank and his features less clear to me than before. Was I losing my memory of him? Or just his approval?
"Grace, are you okay?"
My eyes flew open. I fumbled with the hanger, nearly dropping the dress before finally placing it back onto the rack. "I'm fine. I was just thinking." I turned around. Luke was standing next to the dolly, which was loaded with a weird-looking assortment of lumber, hooks, and other odds and ends, and looking very pleased with himself. "What's all this?"
"Your new display system," he said, and started unloading the cart.
The weird assortment of lumber turned out to be a pegboard that hung at the back of the booth, with hooks that would hold 3 dog jackets each, all at eye level, and 2 revolving wooden clothes trees with 4 screw-in arms that held a half dozen dresses each, all face out, so they were easy to see. Luke finished assembling everything quickly, then took down the unneeded rolling rack and table, loading them back onto the dolly, while I hurried to rehang the dresses and place the dog jackets on the pegboard. By the time I finished, it was 10:05. When I turned around, Luke was halfway down the aisle with the loaded cart, steering his way upstream through the trickle of early shoppers.
"Luke!"
He looked over his shoulder.
"I'll put this in my truck for now. Good luck."
It didn't seem right, letting him leave without saying a proper thank you. I scooped Maisie up in my arms and started after him. As soon as I did, a woman with big sunglasses and blonde braids stepped right in front of me, blocking my path. She looked me up and down, pulled off her glasses,
then squealed and clutched at my skirt. "Gina!" she cried, looking over her shoulder. "Holy crap, Gina! Come over here and look at this." Gina, who apart from having brunette braids instead of blonde, could have been the other woman's twin, stuck her head out of a nearby booth selling diffusers for essential oils. "What?" she asked.